If you think 10 years ago, there were not podcasts like this. There were not, it wasn't in the news in the way that it is now.
Yeah.
You know, people weren't discussing it in Parliament. There wasn't conversations around miscarriage baby loss in the way that there is now.
The Still Parents podcast is proudly supported by Global's Make Some Noise. Click details in the description to find out more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Still Parents podcast supported by Global's Make Some Noise. I'm Dan, and I am here, of course, as ever, with Ryan and with Matthew. Hello, gents. How are you? You all right, Ryan?
I'm very well, thanks.
You're not, are you, though?
No, I'm not.
Ryan's got a bad hip.
Yeah, my hip is not in a good place at the moment.
Do you make noises when you stand up and sit down?
It's like I have to crack myself back into normal shape.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I did the London Landmarks Half Marathon and I got a PB and I was fighting for my life from about mile 11.
Well, congratulations. Good effort, mate.
Really good.
On that.
Yeah, really good.
Speaking of lots of effort, how are you, Matt? Because you're doing 10K every day this year. If it's the first time you've listened to any of the Still Parents podcast, or maybe just first episode this year. So it's going to be the 10th, it's 10 years this year since Matt and Crystal lost Callie. And Matt's challenge is to run 10 kilometres every day for the whole year. How's your body? How's your hip?
No, yeah, it's fine. And I can't complain at all because these people did the half marathon, but Sunday night's run was not good.
Do you know what? I've got absolutely no sympathy for you, and I'll tell you exactly why. So we drove down to London on Sunday morning.
Can I just say?
No, shut up. So we had to leave the house at 6:15, right?
Yeah.
Amy, bless her, is knackered because she hardly slept the night before.
Right.
So I half expected on the drive home, which I drove because I'm a control freak and I don't like being a passenger, right? I half expected that Amy would be asleep in the back.
Yeah.
Little did I know that this Nors opposite us, who's sitting in the passenger seat, his head might as well have just been leaning on my shoulder with his mouth wide open. And I tell you something, I was fuming.
So while you were driving, he was sleeping on your shoulder?
So I've just run a half marathon, but it's all right, mate. You have a nap on the way home. Yeah, I'll drive. Don't worry. It's absolutely fine. You sort yourself out.
This is after everything that he says is a control freak to let people drive down in the first place, like, you know?
But he could have stayed
He just
awake.
Wanted you to offer so he could tell you to fuck off.
There you go. Yeah.
I think it's time to introduce our guest that we do have a guest joining us today. Her name is Ali Harris. How are your hips, Ali? Yeah.
You know what? Listening to you, I didn't want to interrupt there because I cannot contribute because I have not been running for quite a long time. So I felt like if I was to contribute, that would not go down well.
That's the correct thing to do, Ali. Thank you very much.
Ali is joining us from Cambridge. That's right, isn't it?
I am, yeah.
Are you a Cambridge native? You've been there all your life, or where are you originally from?
No. I originally, Norfolk, really.
Oh, okay.
Not born, but bred, I would say. And then moved to London as I was desperate to kind of see something more than sheep and fields. which now, you know, when I was a teenager, I was just so desperate to be in a city and, you know, bright lights and all that kind of stuff. And
now all you see is drug dealers and protest marches.
but then now I'm old. Obviously, I've come back to Cambridgeshire where it's flat and there's big skies and you sort of kind of do a full circle, don't you?
Yeah. Seeing as you've just mentioned it, and because I do feel like, you know, it's one of those traditional questions I shouldn't ask, but you kind of brought it up and I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask, just to give context for the listeners. How old are you then?
49, going to be 50 at the end of this year.
Big birthday, isn't it? Congratulations.
Not yet. Not yet. I'm not accepting it just yet.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, there's a lot to talk about with you. And also, Ali has a book, which is already out. And we'll talk about that. It seems like a good place for me, before we get into your story, Ali, to bring in Matt once again, because he's doing a book, which is...
Book by Matt.
It's called Book by Matt. which is not.
Great title. But it's an inspired title.
I originally started it as a blog because when we lost Callie, I started blogging about how I was doing, how I was fit, because I didn't come across Lily Mae Foundation straight away. I've written it in a style that I've basically written her a bedtime story. All the people in it are like, so I'm Daddy, Crystal's Mommy, and I'm basically telling her the story of what happened before her, what she went through, how it happened, and then what's happened after her, sort of thing. So, yeah.
So. That's so beautiful. It's such an important way to process feelings, isn't it? Writing and sharing stories. And I think it becomes like a legacy.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I feel like at the moment it's taking that leap. I feel like I'm a bit stuck at the not stuck, but I feel like I'm kind of.
How far through are you, Matt?
I've literally finished it.
Excellent.
But I'm almost at that point where I'm like.
Do you mean it's finished, as in the first draft is finished? And you still want to play with it, or share it with anyone?
I do feel like I've written it and it's ready to go, and I feel like I'm at that place now where I can really. But it's just handing it over.
You?
I know. Yeah, it's handing it over to someone else to then like. Yeah.
And that's hard. So, that's really hard. Trust me, I know that. Yeah, I know how hard that is because I don't know how long you've been writing it, or if you've been writing since.
It took me about it took me about 5 years to write it.
Yeah, so and that was very sort of for me from beginning to end. That was a similar time frame.
It's a long time, isn't it?
It's a long time, and you pour obviously your heart, your soul. It becomes a companion, a connection to your baby, and to just hand that over.
Yeah.
You know, when by handing it over, it becomes open to judgment. It becomes open to, you know, criticism or praise. Either way, it feels like you're giving a bit of your heart away, and that can be very hard. You know, there's part of me that definitely felt like I wanted to just keep writing forever.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise it was like almost like another loss all over again.
Yeah. What's the process then when you hand that over? Is it do like these publishers or whoever it may be look at it and rewrite parts of it, or
contribute? I mean, I guess it's different for everybody. I'm obviously part of a sort of traditional publishing process and have been for years. I was an author prior to having children. During having children, I took quite a long break after I lost my baby, Poppy, because it was the one time in my life that I felt that I couldn't write. Just needed to feel and not try and sort of put my experience into a package that I knew that I could make beautiful, and I knew that I could, I knew that people would read. I had not written just for myself for such a long time that I was scared to write because I wasn't ready to share, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I had an agent and I didn't have a publisher. I was out of contract. For me, once I was ready to start writing, I knew that when I wanted to write a book, it would be a book about baby loss because it was the book that I needed to write. It was the book I needed to write, but it was mostly the book I needed to read because after Poppy died, it was the place that I couldn't find anything for me. And books have always been my comfort, the place I go to make sense of the world, particularly novels. And whilst there was a lot of nonfiction, and I read all of that about baby loss and about grief and, you know, surviving grief and people's memoirs and different people's experiences, the gap that I saw was fiction, a place where you could read about this experience and walk the journey of someone who loses a baby that might help the community that I had found myself a part of, but that also might then also reach beyond it to the people who haven't experienced it and that I feel are often outside of this echo chamber that it can feel like we're in, isn't it? You know, that the conversation around baby loss has come on so far because of podcasts like this and people like you and the foundations and the charities and the work, the endless work that people are doing. But sometimes it still feels that people don't actually want to know, that they want to kind of turn away and go, well, that hasn't happened to me, or I don't want that to happen to me, or it hasn't happened to anybody I know. I didn't want anyone to prescribe to me how they felt I should write a book about baby loss. It had to be completely from me. I had to be completely in control about it. You were talking about being a control freak earlier. How am I? I'm late to that.
Wow, it'd be interesting, a car journey with you then. No, I want to drive. I'm driving.
So I very much felt the need to kind of present something and go, this is what it is. I now need some help, because I'm sure you know, Matt, when you're in something and you're writing something, you lose perspective. You know, you cannot edit yourself. It's so hard.
And that's why, that's why I'd send it to my uncle.
That's where you need the outside help. So once you hand it in, that perspective comes from other people reading it and making suggestions and they are suggestions. It is never sort of didactic and like, you must do this and please change this and that sentence. You know, there are suggestions about, you know, this sentence should go, you know, what do you think about maybe this character isn't working quite like this? Could you go away and have a think or a play with this? And it becomes like a sort of cumulative project with everybody on board in that sense, because once you have a team of people and your publishers, if you're lucky, those people care deeply about that story and book, and they know it as well as you do because they read it time and time and time again and get to know and care about those characters and those, well, for me, characters. Obviously for you, Matt, it's incredibly personal. And I relish that journey and that opportunity to collaborate and to hear those opinions. But in the case of this book, never has I been more confident in saying, no, that's not how I'm doing this. Yeah, yeah. This is what this needs to be. This is how I want people to, this is how we're going to talk about this book. This is how I'd love the cover to look. I was much more confident in saying how I felt because I felt that I was the authority on, have gone through the experience of baby loss and being in the community for 14 years. I felt very passionate, and the publishers were incredible at supporting that. Incredible.
That's great. In other words, Matt, get it done.
Yeah. yeah.
But understand that it's hard, but that doesn't, and the whole publishing process was hard. I didn't have a publisher to begin with. I don't know if you're, I have sort of talked about this a bit before, but my book got rejected by pretty much almost every publisher.
I've sent it out to people. I've had a couple of people reject me.
Well, for what reason? What reason?
They said it as neutrally as they thought they could, but they felt the subject was.
But isn't that the whole point? There's not enough resources out there. Yeah. One of the reasons why we're even doing this podcast?
I mean, Ali might be able to tell me a bit more, but I just assumed it was because maybe they were, and it's nonsense in my opinion, but maybe they were worried about the reputation of the group because they were putting their name to this kind of book. I don't know. That's maybe how it came across to me.
You're better off without them if that's what they're worried about.
But like, you know, but like I said, this is why the leap is there to take.
Yeah.
That's why
what
Ali said about kind of the way I've written it. Now that my uncle and my aunt have gone through it with me, and they've basically said to me, they've changed little bits, not changed, but suggested.
Put like capital letters at the start of sentences.
And a full stop at the end.
Yeah.
I can definitely tell that you are an author, Ali, when you said didactic.
Yeah, yeah.
You just popped that in there a few moments ago, like we all know.
I was scrabbling around. I was looking for a dictionary to see what it meant.
I've not been Cambridge for too long.
What do you do for work, Ali?
Well, so up until last year, obviously, I was writing the book full time. I've got three children. So between those two things, that was very much. And some freelance journalism freelance marketing. And I did a bit of retail because I love talking to people. And I found that I was working on my own too much. Once the book came out, I mean, last September and October, I was very busy with all the sort of publicity around the book and everything. And then I was incredibly lucky in the journey that I took with the book to reconnect with a charity that had really helped me when I lost my baby Poppy 14 years ago. And that was Petals, the baby loss counselling charity.
Yeah.
And I had wanted to work them alongside the sort of book publication, having been through the process of experiencing counselling with them 14 years ago and met up with the CEO, and we did some sort of publicity together and chatted a lot. And I went along to one of their conferences to talk to their counsellors and met up once more with my own counsellor, which was hugely emotional because...
Oh, wow. Nice. After how long? After
last year was the 10-year anniversary of Poppy. She would have been 11 last month. Okay. So in September, she was sort of that year that the book was coming out was the 10th anniversary. So... So I met up with my counsellor and she had read the book and we cried and talked and had a lovely time. And then they kindly asked me to become an ambassador for the charity, which I was hugely honoured to say yes to, but kept joking that, you know, I wanted a desk in the office, basically.
have you got one?
I have now, yeah. In last month, yeah, I started as their marketing and communications manager, which makes me hugely proud. It's such an enormous sort of full circle moment.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that I learned from writing the book, from dedicating so many years to writing it, to feeling so passionately about understanding what was needed for the baby loss community and what I could hopefully contribute to it, and what was lacking, you know, what there was space for. I realized that once the book had come out, that I will always be an author. I love writing fiction and I will do that on the side, but it's almost like my purpose had changed along the way from wanting to carry on doing the work for the baby loss community and my main job, and that writing could perhaps take a back seat and be the thing that I do as a hobby, and that I take my time over and do in between everything else that life throws when you've got three kids. And
how old are your three kids?
My eldest is 17, which is petrifying. He's doing his A-levels. He's in his first year of A-levels. I've got
Wow.
Middle girl, she is 15, so she's in year 10. So we're basically on the GCSE A-level trajectory there. And then my little one, Rex, is 8.
What a great name.
I love that name. I love that name.
And he is a king. It means king. And he thinks he's a king and he rules the house. Like,
is he the youngest, but like he's also the bossiest and the oldest kind of? Yeah. That seems to happen a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, most dominating, the biggest presence. He's got us all wrapped around his little.
Let's talk about Poppy. Could you, and I'm not sure how much of the podcast that you've heard yourself, but what we do when we get the guests on is to ask you to share your story about the conception and leading up to the loss in as much detail as you wish to give, or however much detail, and leave out whichever parts that you want. And during that, obviously, because Ryan and Matt have been through this themselves, they will jump in with some questions. So, can you tell us your story, please? And before we do that, sorry, are you married, and what's your other half called?
Yes, my other half, Ben. Yeah, we're married. We've been married for 20 years this
Congratulations.
Year. Thank you very much. Yes, so we're together, and obviously 4 children.
Yeah.
One who just doesn't happen to be with us. Poppy was our third baby. My eldest, I think, was 6 and 5, I think he was. And my youngest was 3 when I fell pregnant with Poppy. I'd always wanted a big family.
Yeah.
I always knew that I wasn't sort of done at 2. And pregnancy was always very easy for me. I seemed to, you know, fall pregnant within the first sort of 3 or 4 months. I was incredibly lucky. My first 2 pregnancies were obviously completely normal. Mm. And I was one of those very lucky people who had never encountered any obstacles in my fertility journey or my pregnancy journey I would say there were obstacles in the birth stories, but we won't go into detail.
Okay.
But, you know, the kind of luck ran out when it came to actually giving birth. But
right. Okay.
that was really hard. It came to Poppy, and absolutely delighted to fall pregnant with her. And went for our 12-week scan, and everything was normal, and we were incredibly excited and told the kids, and they were incredibly excited. It just felt like, you know, the kind of full stop to our story. We were, that was our little lot. And the pregnancy, that first trimester, nothing was any different, really. I'd always sort of been a very happy pregnant woman, you know, liked the fact that, you know, I had these cravings that meant I could eat ridiculous things, mostly things like Monster Munch crisps and, you know.
That's not a bad one, though, is it?
I went back to the 1980s and started kind of craving like Ribena and like.
Did you have any strange, any like non-traditional cravings? Because the cravings you've described are, you know, at least food-based. My wife wanted cigarette ash.
Oh, God.
Really?
Yeah.
No. I remember speaking to somebody once who wanted coal.
Yeah.
They wanted to eat coal.
No.
Apparently, it's not that rare.
Crystal's mum loved the smell of petrol.
I still love the smell of petrol.
But when she was pregnant, she literally apparently used to go and sit just at the petrol station.
That can't be healthy.
Can't be, right. But yeah. But Crystal's the way she is. Yeah.
My friend liked the smell, and it was the smell of new shoe. You know, like, you know, when you walk into like Clark's or something, like, you get that new shoe smell. They just wanted to sniff shoes when they were pregnant. So it's like, imagine someone like eight, big belly going around going, can I have that in a size 8?
I now feel entirely normal. With monster munch and think, roast beef flavour.
Yeah, I think you're fine with a bit of monster munch. but sorry to go down that route. But yeah.
No, so everything as far as we knew and thought was completely normal. And then we were coming up for our 20-week scan, and we had decided that this time around, because we had never found out before the gender of babies, but because the age that our other two children were at, you know, 5 and sort of 3.5, and because it was our third, we decided that we were going to find out so that they could know whether they were having a brother or sister. It felt like a nice way to mark pregnancy is different, you know, because it didn't matter to us either way. We had a boy and a girl. We were, you know, there was no...
What did your other children want? Did they...
They did, you know, I don't think they specified, or I can't remember. They weren't sort of demanding anything. They were just delighted that I was pregnant, having a baby. Oh. I think they just wanted a baby.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think they'd got as far as going, I want it to be a brother or a sister.
Right, okay.
So, but they were excited to find out.
Yeah, yeah.
They certainly didn't specify, or I don't remember any kind of like, I want to have a brother, you know, that kind of... going on. So we went along to our 20-week scan in what now I can reflect upon was an incredibly naive state, because 20-week scans before had been a positive place to see our baby and to, you know, and this particular one was going to be the one where we were going to actually find out the gender. Went in, and the, you know, sonographer started scanning me, and it was taking quite a bit of time, but she was a very good actress. You know, she was sort of doing the classic, oh, you know, baby's in a bit of a funny position and just struggling to get a couple of measurements, and we'll just have a little move here, and oh, perhaps you could go and have a chocolate bar or something and go and have a little walk around and a cup of tea and then come back in.
Could you sense anything, you know, like your intuition?
I'd say completely naive.
Well, why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I was like delighted to be told to go and have some chocolate.
Well, yeah.
I couldn't fathom that there would be anything wrong. Yeah. I had never had any cause to believe there would be anything wrong.
Okay.
And I had never, I guess, allowed my brain to go down that route, because why would you if your pregnancies have been normal before?
Exactly.
I can totally understand why. And the conversations like we're having now, if you think 10 years ago, there were not podcasts like this. There were not, it wasn't in the news in the way that it is now.
Yeah.
You know, people weren't discussing it in Parliament. There wasn't conversations around miscarriage, baby loss in the way that there is now. So yes, I knew about miscarriage, but we were past 12 weeks. Everything was fine. You know, it was kind of that basic. We went out and had a wander. And when we came back into the scanning room, the sonographer had been joined by someone else, which at that point, I think I was kind of like, oh, okay. I'm now just trying to
take all the time you need.
What was said, they, because there was different processes, basically, they said that they had detected some issues with baby, that the baby had a hole in the heart, and they needed to run some more tests, and that they would need to do that somewhere else other than at my hospital, and that we were going to be referred to Great Ormond Street Hospital.
Wow, okay.
That's
quite a step up then, isn't it? So which hospital were you originally? Sorry, I've just in my head.
This was at Addenbrookes.
Right, okay.
Yeah. It was a big step up, but just to give a little bit of context, my daughter, who was then 3.5 at the time, when she was born, at her 24-hour check in hospital, they had discovered a hole in her heart.
Okay.
And she was referred to Great Ormond Street for her six weeks later to go and have her checked.
Okay.
So that the sort of the mirroring of that, the experience that we'd had with our daughter, which was in the end positive. Like, it had been a shock at the 24 hours that she had, that, to be told that she had this hole in her heart. They were very positive and said most babies it can close by the time 6 weeks come, so it might be that she'd be completely fine.
Right.
She was a very, very happy, healthy baby. And in that 6 weeks, we were not worried at all.
Okay.
She was like an incredible sleeper. She was, we didn't allow ourselves to be worried. And, you know, we went for our 6 week scan and it had closed.
Right.
So
I guess with that parallel then, so there was, although concerning, it's like, okay, well, this is,
there was, you know, I think that I wasn't naive enough to think, well, this has been discovered in pregnancy, which means obviously it's more of, because my daughters hadn't been. But it wasn't like we were being given this terrible diagnosis. It was a diagnosis that my previous understanding was this can change. And, you know, at the time, I also remember the sonographer had then said, would you like to find out, you know, the gender of your baby? We said, yes, absolutely. We found out we were having a little girl. We were delighted. The car journey home, I remember talking to my husband, and we were not devastated because we were still in a place of naivety. We believed that it was going to be okay. I do remember saying to him, I just want to look into a bit. I want to do a bit of research because I know that I was sort of not naive enough to think that, because, like I say, the hole had been found in pregnancy, that perhaps there might be something more serious than we'd had with our daughter. So I said, I do want to just sort of do a bit of research. And my husband basically said, please don't. I don't think you should. Let's just wait.
Yeah.
When we got home, I seem to recall that our scan was on the Friday, and we got a call that day to say, please, can you come on Monday to Great Ormond Street? And I remember thinking, that's really fast for the NHS.
Yeah.
And at that point, I started to get worried.
Yeah.
But I also did my bit of research that was not a deep dive, because I think I wanted to protect myself. I just wanted to read positive stuff. And everything that I had searched on the surface basically said that, you know, I can't specifically remember the statistics, you know, like 95% of babies that are born with a hole in their heart, they heal. That if it's found during pregnancy, then it's this, that, and the other. Yes, it can be a marker for other things, but I then did not look at what those other things were.
Right, yeah, okay.
Because we were going to have this other scan, so it was kind of like, it's all going to be fine.
Yeah.
I do remember that I sat and created a Pinterest board for her one night. I couldn't sleep on the Saturday night, and I spent the entire night creating a Pinterest board for her three, as a way, I think, of just sort of willing her into the world.
Yeah.
So I think there was definitely anxiety there.
Yeah.
And then we went to Great Ormond Street on that Monday, and it was in that scan that we were told completely devastating news that she was diagnosed with Edwards syndrome. And we were told that due to the many, many markers that she had, she was a very unwell baby and would not survive the pregnancy, let alone the birth. And if on the kind of tiniest chance that she was to survive the pregnancy, that she would die during birth, because they could not fix the hole in her heart. They would not fix the hole in her heart with a baby that was that big, and she would die. So we were taken to a room. That diagnosis took a while to come through. We were sort of sat in a waiting room for a really long time, waiting for a consultant to come back with what they suspected. It wasn't a total diagnosis. They came back and said, this is what we think it is. This is the decision that we are now presenting you with, which was, as I always describe it, like, literally a decision with like a no choice. Like, it was like, you either continue with the pregnancy knowing your baby will die, or you stop the pregnancy now.
Ali, which can I ask a question? Because with Edwards syndrome, obviously there's lots of other characteristics that are linked, that are
You know, part of sadly having that type of syndrome, you know, things like brain structure, you know, sort of abdominal issues as well, craniofacial issues and stuff. Had there not been any prior blood tests that had even remotely even given an alarm? Because I know, obviously, the reason I ask about the hole in the, and I'm going to ask about the hole in the heart as well, is my niece had a hole in the heart. She had a VSD, so it was between the left ventricle, right ventricle, and then was told exactly the same thing, that sometimes they can close, sometimes she and she ended up having open heart surgery to have that.
Wow. How old was she when she had that?
When she had it, she was, I want to say, about 6 weeks. She had to get to a certain weight or something like that, because she was also brought prematurely because of that hole at the same time. And I know from at the time as well, there was a lot of screening for things like Down syndrome as well, because it can be quite common in Down syndrome babies as well. So obviously that is going to come as a massive shock to you, that they tell you at that point that she's got Edwards syndrome. Did they just diagnose that solely from the hole in the heart?
No, it wasn't. There were other markers.
Okay.
So her fists were clenched.
Yeah.
You know, there was issues with some of her other organs. But they said that it was what they were pretty much sure it was. But we could have an amniocentesis if we wanted, you know, which is kind of drawing blood, isn't it, from to get that absolute definite diagnosis. And because of that, we chose to have that amniocentesis, which was a few days later. And a few days later after that, we were given the diagnosis.
Yeah.
She definitely did have Edwards syndrome. So it was a process still. So yes, it does. And I guess it's different for everybody. I know that amniocentesis, some people, you know, there is a risk to having an amniocentesis as well, because it carries a risk of miscarriage. But because of what we were being asked to choose, because of the situation that we were being put in, which was termination for medical reasons, which I had never heard of. Literally had the entire experience was such a traumatic, an enormous shock, you know, and because of that, for me personally, I needed to have that amniocentesis, because I needed absolute reassurance that what I was going to have to do, because we knew what we were going to have to do for me, for what we felt was for Poppy, like, and for our children, that I couldn't continue this pregnancy knowing that she was going to die. That was, you know, I was, and so I had to be sure that there really was no hope, because I'm also the sort of person, you know, I'm an author of fiction, I'm a romantic. Yeah. I like, you know, I was sat there building a Pinterest board, you know, and not wanting to really hear the news of something being wrong. Yeah. I would always err on the side of hope and it will be okay. It's going to be okay. Of course it's going to be okay. So I needed that absolute certainty that it really wasn't, and that therefore we, you know, we were going to have to go through the next awful experience, you know, that you just would never, ever choose.
No, absolutely. And we have supported so many clients through the charity, and we've actually had people on the podcast as well, haven't we, who they've had to make that decision to terminate a pregnancy for medical reasons, where, again, they've It's not just a case of, you know, making that decision for yourself. It's like you've just said there, you've made the decision for her and what her quality of life was going to be, or you know, your other children as well, yourselves and what have you. So a lot of the feedback that we get from people is that they feel that termination for medical reasoning is very much looked at differently towards somebody that's maybe had a stillbirth or a neonatal death or a miscarriage, because you've actually had to make that decision between you and your husband to end that pregnancy and end that life. Can you talk to us about the sort of emotions and everything that was linked to that?
It was the stigma and silence and shame and all of those things were instant. I, from myself, as much as anything, that it, there was almost like an inbuilt societal kind of judgment of me instantly, you know, not, yeah. not by anybody, but just an internal realization yeah. that because of this phrase, which I still don't, I still think that terminology, termination of, for medical reasons, yeah. I don't like it.
It's just very cold, isn't it?
So cold yeah. and hard.
Clinical.
And
it's very clinical as well.
TFMR, like yeah. I've said before that I've heard it called compassionate induction, and I would far rather talk about it in that sense because it there's so much we know, you know, you all know, and in the community we all know that there's so much of the language around baby loss is so medicalized yeah. and cold and hard and very hard to talk about. And I think I had never heard the phrase termination for medical reasons, and I don't think many people had 10 years ago. It wasn't something that was discussed for me. I didn't know where to turn to talk about it. At the time, there, like I said earlier, there wasn't podcasts, there wasn't pieces in newspapers, there wasn't, no one talked about it. It was the big taboo.
Mm. I must say, I'd never heard of it. Sorry to put in, I started the podcast with them, we've had, as tobacco what Ryan said, a lot of our guests, and we can now categorise the guests that we've got into, and again, I realise I'm doing it myself, being quite clinical in the way I'm phrasing it, but a lot of the episodes have been based around guests that have come on because of termination for medical reasons. And first time I heard it, I was sat in this very chair, and I just kind of looked at these because I didn't know it's one of those things, isn't it? You wouldn't hear about it, I guess, until it happens. But and it just sounded so clinical, so cold. And what was the one you said? The compassionate
induction.
I mean, it's got an emotion attached to it, hasn't it?
Just emotion. Yeah. I know. It's kind of acknowledges that the choice that you're making is for compassion for your baby and compassion for yourself and compassion for the people around you. And that is what being pregnant and being a mother means as well, is that in those moments, making those decisions, in the things that we had to do for Poppy, it was never about me. It was never about me. It was about me carrying pain so that other people had to protect my children, to protect my baby, to, you know, and so to call it a termination, to call it, you know, to and I, you know, I use that term myself because I don't feel like anything else, people, you know, it gets marked as that, but I still find it incredibly hard. And I don't believe that there is as much of a stigma anymore. I'm so thankful and grateful that, you know, podcasts and for so many reasons, we are talking about it much more. This would never have been discussed 10 years ago. Yeah. And I found myself completely lost, completely silenced, not knowing really even what my loss was, how to class it. I couldn't call it. I felt like I couldn't call it a stillbirth, even though I had delivered her. I couldn't call it a miscarriage because she was a baby that I delivered. I didn't have any terminology. I felt like a fraud. I felt like I was stuck in this like awful, messy middle in the dark, in the fog, in the shame and in the silence. And, you know, that I couldn't even tell closest friends to begin with because I just didn't have the language for it. And I also felt incredibly protective of Poppy and my experience of being a mother, and incredibly passionate that I would not give that information to people that weren't going to hold it carefully and gently, that if it was to, you know, it couldn't be local gossip. You know, I live in a village. I was visibly pregnant. I was 21. I couldn't have people going, did you hear what happened? You know, like,
oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
There was not a moment where I felt that this precious trauma, this, that also, you know, the experience of delivering Poppy was mine and something that I hold very carefully and proud 10 years on. And I couldn't share it.
Yeah.
And it took years for me to be able to do that. And I think it obviously coincided with the way that social media brought baby loss into more of a spotlight, that there became this community, that it wasn't just faceless, almost like bots on forums, which is what it was 10 years ago when I did try and search about Edwards syndrome and termination for medical reasons. I found forums and I found them petrifying because I didn't know if the people in there were in there because they had actually had a personal experience,
yeah,
or they had an opinion about that experience that they felt that they wanted to impart.
Or are they even real?
We had something very similar, being in hospital on the night after Amy had just given birth to Lily, and she found a forum. I think...
Is it Mum's Net?
I genuinely think it was an old Sans forum, which I'm not entirely sure if they still do them anymore.
Okay.
But Amy was told that she was lying about what had happened. Because you did get people...
What's wrong with people, man?
Because you've just got idiots in the world, haven't you? But
yeah,
the thing I was going to ask you as well there, Ali, is we tend to find as well with a lot of people who do come for support through the charity, who have had to make the decision to terminate a pregnancy, is that they also feel that the support that is out there is that they're not, what's the word I'm looking for, that they can't access it because they had to make that decision.
Well, I was, and this goes back to where I am now at Petals, I was incredibly lucky that at the time Petals had a contract with Adam Brooks, so I was connected with them quite early on. And I think so I had Poppy in November, in the middle of November, and in early January I reached out to Poppy's and started I had 6 counselling sessions with them, which was completely life-changing. Mm. You know, in terms of teaching me how to unlock my grief and how to be heard and how to have a perspective on my experience. My counsellor taught me that I'd had a stillbirth, allowed me to sit with that and sit with my experience, and it made me feel not alone, and all the things, you know, and unlocked so much of the shame that was in my head, and the pain and the trauma and the fear and the hope and the, you know, because I also, you know, knew that I wanted to have more children, but I was still so locked in this grief and shame and pain that I didn't know what to do with everything that was going on in my brain. I'm sure you guys all know from your partners and how differently we all grieve and how hard it is to process that and how hard it is to share even with the closest people around you.
So that was pretty soon then, wasn't it? So was it January, you said, after the...
Yeah, I think I just, you know, I've always... You know, I've always known myself well. I've always sort of been able to sort of tap into where I'm at emotionally. And I was very, very aware that I had 2 children at home that needed their mum, and that I, in order to survive it, I had to sort of step up and deal with the grief and not just pretend that it wasn't there and not just try and cover it up so that I could, you know, get on with the business of being a mum to 2 young children. Yeah. I was really aware that if I did that, if I locked it all away, I was going to fall apart over time and it would probably be devastating. And,
Can I just say, it's a conversation, because we bring up obviously the counselling conversation comes up a fair bit with guests that we have on, and a theme which is, I mean, this is slightly stereotypical, but maybe because there's an element of truth in it. So it seems to take the guys a lot longer to go, you know what, I'm going to go for the counselling. And we've had instances of, there was one guest who took a while, then he used to go to counselling sessions with his wife, but he felt like he was quite marginalised within the group, as in like sat at the back. Was it Ian Lawton, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said his life-changing thing was when he went to a dad's only support group and he's met some of his closest new friends from there, because obviously they're, you know, kindred spirits, they're, you know, they're united through grief, unfortunately, but also... Yeah. You know, in to take any positive from it is the fact that the community that he's met, and it's changed his world in different elements as well, just from his health, his fitness, and all things like that. I know, and we've mentioned it, we've touched on this before. To Matt, was it quite a few years before Matt went down that route? And I think the reason why I'm saying this is just, and we've got links again to support groups in the episode description. It's, and the reason why we set this up in the first place is just talk, isn't it, and listen.
Absolutely. And I think it is still the kind of the missing many are the dads. And we know why. We know that men find it difficult to talk. We know that we feel, you know, there is this feeling that they have to be the strong ones, that they have to be the ones getting on with the business of keeping everything going, that work, earning money, that the responsibility of being, you know, the man and the one that is kind of cradling a partner when they have experienced something that has happened, not just to them, but inside of them. And that that grief then takes priority because, you know, it is the most sort of prescient and visible that that there is, that, you know, your partner has either lost a baby within her or had to deliver a baby that or not alive. And your job then becomes about supporting her and ensuring that she survives it and that you survive the day to day, because perhaps she can't cope with the day to day through those really awful, awful early weeks and months. And so that responsibility becomes the priority for the man. And then they forget about actually that they have been through it too.
We'd love to speak to you again at some point, or maybe if you're up in the area to come in and join us on a future episode.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I want to hear about Matt's book as well. So Matt, please, like, I would like a copy. I would like to know that you're sending it out and being brave. You've already been so brave. You know,
it will get there. I will. It will. Absolutely.
Ali, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really lovely to virtually meet you all.
Yes.
And you.
This has been the Still Parents podcast, supported by Globals. Make some noise. All the details on our socials, our app, which you can download, are in the description. If you'd like to join us on the show at any point, please get in touch. And although we don't really want you to be here, we appreciate that you are. And that is your lot from us. We'll see you very soon. Take care, everyone.
See Bye-bye. You guys.
The Still Parents podcast is proudly supported by Globals. Make some noise. Click details in the description to find out more.